Well, hello everyone. I'm Dr. Leslie Kernison, board-certified geriatrician and the founder of BetterHealthWhileAging.net. And this is the Better Health While Aging video podcast, where we discuss common health problems that affect people over age 60 and the best ways to prevent and manage those problems. We also often address common concerns and dilemmas that come up with aging parents and other older loved ones, like what to do if you're worried about falls or safety or memory or even the quality of an older person's healthcare. So in today's episode, I want to address a question that I'm often asked, which is how can we plan to age well, to have what is sometimes referred to as successful aging? And I think this is a great question and a really interesting one for me to think about because since my work is to help older adults and especially families, and I'm generally helping them later in life when they're really experiencing a lot of age-related health challenges, I've had a lot of experience seeing how these health challenges play out for older adults and families. And the truth is that, you know, sometimes I think it's a little harder than it had to be, in part because of the way people did or did not plan ahead. So I've become really interested in the question of, you know, is it somehow possible to help people earlier in life lay kind of a different course for themselves so that they have a better time during those years where things are more challenging? So I've thought about it, and in this video, I want to share with you what has come up for me when it comes to planning for successful aging in hopes that it's going to help you plan ahead for a time in your future. And so specifically, what I want to cover in this episode is, first of all, I want to talk about what is successful aging so that we can be on the same page about what are the goals that we're working towards. And then I'm going to take you through my current thinking about three key steps to implement successful aging. So first, what does successful aging mean? Now, this is a question that has been explored, especially in the gerontology literature. So gerontology, not to be confused with geriatrics. Geriatrics is a medical specialty. Gerontology is the social sciences discipline of all things aging. So it's especially gerontologists in academia who have explored this question. And a really common definition that was defined in the 80s was that successful aging meant that three things. One, freedom from disease and disability. Two, that you had high cognitive and physical functioning. And three, that you had active engagement with life. Now, of course, all of this sounds appealing, and you probably know people who are even in their 90s and still appear to be meeting these criteria, which is great. But what was striking to me with this definition is that this is defining successful aging as basically you get to keep living as you did earlier in life. And it's really nice if that can work out. But the truth is that often it doesn't work out, right? So there are problems with this model. And the problem is that most people, for reasons that I will get into in this episode, you know, are not successful by age 85. By age 85, they have experienced some challenges to one of these three criteria. So this is a model that is fundamentally kind of ableist and in a way is sort of negative about aging because it's defining successful aging as basically acting as a younger person. So I don't consider this myself successful aging. I really think of it more as lucky aging. And yes, people can to a certain extent make their own luck through some of the choices they make in life. There's also genetics and other factors that play into this. So what would be another way that we could think of successful aging? Here's the definition that I really like right now that was defined by other gerontologists subsequent to the first definition. And in their definition, they really framed it as successful aging meant being reasonably successful in adapting to the challenges of aging. So they posited that, you know, the truth of aging is that for almost everybody, it involves eventually experiencing changes, stressors, losses, things like chronic illnesses, declines in ability, and personal losses. And so successful aging was not about whether you managed to avoid any of that. It was about how well you managed to adapt and make adaptations so that you still retain some quality of life, even as these challenges occur and your life changes. And so they said that that success really comes from being able to marshal your internal resources and also external resources to effectively cope with age-related challenges. And they shared some examples of what those resources and adaptations might look like. So they actually defined the adaptations in two categories. So one was preventive. So doing things like health promotion, planning ahead, helping others, anticipatory moving, you know, so moving to a space where you might be able to still live even if your abilities changed. And then they said there are corrective adaptations, which are basically things that people do when the change has happened or the crisis has hit. It's how they marshal support from others or accept help from others and accept changes once there is an actual change in their life. Another thing I really liked about this model is that the successful outcome was not, are you still behaving the way you were 20 years ago? But it was really more about how is your quality of life? So it was less about abilities and more about quality of life and related to things like life satisfaction, meaning, still maintaining some valued activities and relationships, and your own sense of your success. So now I just want to speak to a common pitfall that I want to encourage you to avoid when it comes to planning for successful aging. And that is, don't equate successful aging with never declining and never needing help. That is an extremely high standard that most of us, myself included, are unlikely to hit. And what we know, both from research and also I can tell you from lots of personal experience, you know, walking this journey with lots of older adults and their families, is that it's the older adults who are able to adapt to changes and accept some assistance who do better in those later years of their life. This also has a very important side benefit of reducing stress and conflict for their families. So in short, successful aging, in my book, means finding ways to cope and adapt by marshaling your internal and external resources so that you can continue to experience life satisfaction, meaning, connection, and valued activities, even if, or really when, you experience personal losses, declines in abilities, chronic health issues, or health crises. So now that we're hopefully on the same page about what is successful aging, the question is, well, how do you plan for that? How do you prepare for that? How do you equip yourself for that? And when I first thought about this question, I came up with like two key steps. You know, one is you want to optimize your health and well-being now. And that's for two reasons. One is that that gives you the best possible quality of life in the short term. When our health is good and when we're feeling good, it's good for our quality of life and it enables us to participate in our life in ways that are more meaningful, more fulfilling, more important. But also, when we optimize our health and well-being now, that is really the best way to prevent or delay age-related problems in the longer term. And I'll talk a little bit more, I'll get more into specifics in a moment about that. So that was the first step. But then the second step is along with that, and this is the part that I think people often have some difficulty doing, is to plan for interdependence. And by that, I mean, it's to expect, I mean, we can hope for the best, but it's good to plan for the likely. It's to expect that it's very likely that you will eventually experience some form of reduced abilities, which means that you are going to need support and perhaps be dependent on others in some way. And so to plan for interdependence means to take steps now or soon, you know, before the need arises, to prepare for this and lay a good foundation so that when the time comes to make those adaptations, you're ready. And I can talk more about what goes into that in a moment as well. So for a while, those were my two steps. But then as I thought about this more and did more research and looking into it, I realized that there's a third step that is really important that I'm actually going to list as number one. And that is to cultivate a positive attitude about your own aging. And that's in part because, one, very good for quality of life, but it makes it much easier to do the other steps of optimizing your health and well-being now and of planning for interdependence. So what does it mean to cultivate a positive attitude about aging? This isn't just, you know, think positive, right? But this means cultivating positive beliefs about your own aging, because the truth is many of us actually have internalized quite negative beliefs about aging and about our own aging. This is not something that we can just decide to do like that and start doing. It's definitely a process, but to explain what we're aiming for, this is about really digging into our perception of our own aging and how it affects our life, including how it affects our quality of life, our energy, our happiness, our feelings of usefulness. And there are questions that have been developed to help people assess their attitude about their own aging. They're questions like, do you feel that as you get older, you are less useful? So what the research overwhelmingly shows is that more positive self-perceptions of aging have been linked to better health and better outcomes. So not only are you happier, but you live better, you live longer. There was even one very interesting provocative study where people who had mild cognitive impairment, also known as minor neurocognitive disorder, and if you want to know more about that, I have a video about it. But when people have mild cognitive impairment, some of them progress to develop a dementia such as Alzheimer's, and some of them stay stable and some of them get better. So it was found that people who had more positive self-perceptions of aging were more likely to recover from mild cognitive impairment. Now, the challenge with maintaining a positive attitude about our own aging is that society tends to bombard us with negative associations with aging. So many of us do have this internalized ageism, but research has shown that attitudes about aging can be improved. And the pioneer in this work, or one of the pioneers, is really Professor Becca Levy, who is at Yale, who has done lots of amazing research on this, has also written a good book about it. So she found that subliminally presented positive age stereotypes improved physical function in older adults. So the mind-body connection is really powerful. And when we have a more positive feeling about our aging, our abilities, and the fact that, you know, aging doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to lose our quality of life and other things that matter to us, that's a really powerful thing. So how can you go about doing this? Again, the idea is not to sort of force positive thinking about your aging. My personal feeling is that one place to start is to start off just by becoming more aware of one's own attitudes towards one's aging. You know, what is coming up for you? I think it's important to acknowledge and process fears. A lot of our fear of aging is a negative attitudes about it, is that we're afraid of what we will lose, you know, our capabilities and independence, looks. I mean, it can be all kinds of things. And then to really work on cultivating acceptance and gratitude. And that is something that is a practice, really, over time. And then we can also seek out positive aging role models. And by doing that, I don't mean just looking for, you know, the 95-year-old who is running marathons. I mean looking for the older person who, you know, who has had health challenges and has had to change things and lives differently, maybe had to move, and is still, you know, maintaining a positive attitude about it and finding good things in it. So I really encourage looking for positive aging models, who have made those adaptations. Let me now move on to step two in my formula, which is optimizing health and well-being in aging. So how do we do this? So I was asked about this years ago, and I came up with a healthy aging checklist. I thought of, you know, all the things that I would do if I was trying to help an older person have the best possible health and well-being right now. And it would be things like this. You know, one, promote brain health and emotional well-being. I actually have a video in which I go into this in depth if you want to watch that. Next, there's promoting physical health, which I have an article about this on Better Health While Aging, but, you know, exercise is a very big part of that. Then there's checking for and addressing commonly neglected aging health problems, problems like falls or continence issues or taking too many medications. Then there's optimizing the management of any chronic condition. So if you have been diagnosed with a chronic condition, whether it's high blood pressure or something more substantial like chronic lung disease, the way you care for that condition will affect your quality of life, will affect how quickly often the condition progresses, which then can affect, you know, how often you're going to the emergency room or being hospitalized or even experiencing disability. Then there's getting recommended preventive health care services as well. So that's the list. So just to keep this episode not too long, I'm not going to go into each of these in depth today. But again, I do have a video right now about brain health and emotional well-being. I have one about exercise to help with aging. And I have articles about all of these on my website with related cheat sheets if you want to take a look. So what about the question of how do you prevent or delay age-related problems? So people often want to know that. How do I prevent or delay getting Alzheimer's? How do I prevent or delay getting weak and frail and having to move? And the answer is actually to use the same approach as to optimize your health right now. So those are the things to do. The sooner you do them and the more consistently you do them, the better. So again, you know, brain health, physical health, I do recommend checking for those common aging health problems, again, because they also get in people's way, optimizing the management of any chronic conditions and getting recommended preventive healthcare services. So let me now talk about a common pitfall that I see and encourage you to avoid it. So what I have found over the years is that people are really interested in healthy aging, in preventing the sort of problems they see other older adults having, But often they're looking for a certain thing. And so they're asking me, you know, what is the right vitamin that I should take? What are the right supplements? What is the right brain training activity? And the thing is that there is no like specific single thing. Actually, probably the closest single thing, if I had to pick one, would be exercise. But these other things that people are often trying, a vitamin, a supplement, brain training activity, these almost never work in randomized clinical trials. I think the body is too complicated, and that what people really need is, first of all, an approach that addresses many aspects of health. And the other is that, especially if you have any significant health conditions, it's getting those under control and managing them as well as possible. So in my experience, doing things to optimize your brain health, your emotional health, and your physical health through lifestyle approaches is what's effective. I especially recommend social engagement, social connection, social engagement, stress management, and exercise. And then I'm also personally a fan of minimizing brain slowing medications if you can. I have some videos about that. It's something we do a lot in geriatrics. And remember, a positive mindset about aging does help delay declines in cognitive health and in physical health. So now we've covered, you know, cultivating a positive attitude about your own aging, optimizing your health and well-being now. So let me now talk about the third step in preparing for successful aging, which is to plan for interdependence. And by that, again, I mean, you know, expecting that you'll eventually experience some form of reduced abilities. And it's really important to try to keep a positive and accepting attitude about this, right? Remember, it is not incompatible to have lost certain abilities, which honestly is going to happen to most of us if we are lucky enough to live a long time, is not incompatible with experiencing life satisfaction, finding meaning, or having a good quality of life. So let's talk now about how we can actually do this, you know, take those steps to plan for interdependence. So what does it mean to do this? I think of interdependence as referring to a time when our well-being is more intimately connected to the actions and support of others. Now, we all experience this when we're first born, as young children and in childhood. We're deeply, deeply dependent on others. And then, you know, in adulthood, we have a lot of independence and autonomy and ability to care for ourselves. And the truth is that we do better when we are still connected to actions and support of others. We are social creatures. And then, you know, there are going to be times in our life if we are sick or unwell, when we need more care and support of others. And then again, for many of us, there will be a stage in our later life when we will need more support from others as well. So planning for this is sometimes called, you know, advanced care planning as well. Now, advanced care planning, you know, within healthcare is usually like narrowly referring to the process of completing an advanced directive for healthcare, designating a durable power of attorney for healthcare, doing a living will, and really, you know, providing, you know, planning for if you had a very significant life-threatening medical emergency, what should other people do? But I think it's good to think beyond that because, first of all, as we get older, often assistance beyond the strictly medical is going to be needed. So that can be things like help with your daily living activities, right? Help with transportation if you're no longer able to drive. Help with finances if you have started to develop a problem with memory or thinking and, you know, are having difficulty with that. Or, you know, help with grocery shopping if you have really bad arthritis and, you know, navigating the grocery store is beyond you. So some of the things that I think are good to consider is, you know, if or really when, you know, we should assume it's a when we reach that stage where we needed help and support from others, who would be involved? Who might be involved? Who are our options? Who are the possibilities? Where would we like to be? And who might provide actual hands-on care if it were needed? And how could it be paid for or accessed? So to do this, I came up with 5 specific steps, you know, which is basically 1, you find out more about what might happen to you. I'm going to talk a bit about what tends to happen to many older adults, but you can also talk with your health provider because what is likely to happen to you partly depends on what's going on with your health and, you know, the diagnoses that you have. You want to consider options for managing what might happen in the future. You want to express your values and preferences when it comes to the kind of care or situation that you might get. You want to choose surrogate decision makers, and then you want to complete legal paperwork. So let's now talk a little bit about what might happen in the future as we get older. So the nature of aging is that we become more susceptible to chronic diseases and to health crises. we also become less physically and cognitively resilient. So that means that it becomes easier to get much sicker from things like the flu, COVID, bacterial infections. It becomes easier to fall, right? And some falls lead to very significant injuries. Many an older person has had their life totally changed by a hip fracture or a head injury. When we get sick, whether it's from our chronic condition or from, you know, a new infection, it often takes longer to recover from illnesses and injuries. It takes longer to build our strength back up so that we can comfortably move around our house. So what this means for people, every person's aging journey is different. But, you know, some of the things that I see often that I would say are pretty common is people might be in pretty good shape and then have a sudden health crisis that they survive, but results in diminished abilities, you know, such as a major stroke. Or people often develop a chronic condition that causes frequent symptoms and over time, you know, gets worse and ends up causing frequent hospitalizations. So some examples of this would be conditions such as, you know, heart failure, which in its early stages can be very manageable. But, you know, when people have had it for quite a while, or if it gets really bad, it can be something where they're often in and out of the hospital for it. Same thing goes for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Another thing that does happen to some people, a fair number of people, especially if they get old enough, is developing cognitive impairment, developing changes in memory or thinking that eventually progress to Alzheimer's or another form of dementia. And again, the longer you live, the more likely it is to come up. And then there are other people who don't have anything like really specific that comes up, but they just over time, you know, are having slow physical decline. They're getting a little frailer and weaker, and they might end up being quite frail and having frequent falls, even though they don't otherwise have a problem with their memory or thinking or a really significant health condition that's kind of like often causing them to have symptoms or end up needing medical attention. And then there's also developing a condition such as cancer, which, you know, in some cases can sort of be like another chronic condition that goes on for many years, and in other cases can become quite significant and cause people to decline fairly steadily or even quite quickly. So those are the common things. And yeah, I mean, they all present challenges for older adults and also for families and those who are around them. Now, what is less common, but I think is what many of us are hoping for, is to remain completely independent with no limitations or abilities until the day you die or shortly before. Now, this does happen sometimes. Some of the ways that it can happen, people sometimes die suddenly due to an accident. It can be a motor vehicle accident, or a bad, you know, fall and a head injury. People can die suddenly due to a heart attack or a major stroke. People can die after a brief severe illness. We saw this a lot, you know, during the COVID pandemic. But it also, you know, there are other ways for it to happen, that people get sick, they get hospitalized, and, you know, they die in the hospital or fairly soon afterwards. And then there are some people who just don't have any significant decline in abilities, and then one day they die in their sleep. This is, you know, when I ask people, this is often held up as like the thing everyone is hoping will happen to them. It does happen to some people. You know, I've certainly heard of it happening, but it's not what's going to happen to most of us. So in terms of the statistics, what we know about how people die, this is from the National Center on Health Statistics. And in 2022, the top causes of death in the U.S., you know, top was heart disease, 700,000 deaths, followed by cancer, 600,000 deaths, accidents, 227,000. COVID was 186,000. Now, we still had a fair amount of COVID mortality going on then. It's much less, you know, the preliminary estimate for 2023 is that it was 76,000 deaths from COVID. So COVID used to be, you know, during the pandemic years was like the number, you know, three or four cause of death, and now it's probably going to be number 10. Stroke, 165,000, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD, 147,000, Alzheimer's, 120,000, diabetes, 100,000, kidney disease, 57,000, liver disease, 54,000. Now, these are people of all ages, but many of them are older. So let me now speak to another pitfall that is good to avoid as we're thinking about this. I really want to encourage you to not just plan for your end of life. I cannot tell you how many people I've talked to about have they done any planning for their future or advanced care planning. And people often have this very narrow vision of, you know, well, if I'm about to die, here's where I want to be and here's what I want it to be like. And it's important to think about that. That's useful information for your health providers to know, for your family to know. But what I have often wished people had spent more time doing is planned for their last few months or years of life, you know? And again, thought if they were in a stage of needing help and support from others for months or even for a year or two, what would they like that to look like? Because it is likely that most of us will experience months to years of requiring some support and assistance before we die. Because what happens if you don't plan? And let me tell you, most people have not planned. So this is what I and my colleagues who are geriatric care managers, also known as aging life care professionals, are dealing with, and countless families are dealing with also as they try to help older adults address elder care. But when there has not been planning, there is more stress for your family and care circle. There's less control for you, and there is more difficulty meeting your needs in the ways that you would prefer. So in terms of options for managing interdependence, some of the things that I would encourage you to think about, again, you know, is who will be involved, who could serve as a surrogate decision maker, who else could provide some form of support or assistance, where would you like to be? The answer to this for most people is, I want to be at home until I die. Okay, that's fine. But what would it take to keep you at home? And what are your options for providing that, right? So often it takes the hands-on labor or support of somebody else to stay at home. Is that going to be feasible, right? To either pay for or have family members step up? What are other locations you might consider living as an alternative, and under what circumstances? And again, who might provide hands-on care if it's needed? How could it be paid for and accessed? And if you want to learn more about the options for this, I have a video that I did with my social work colleague, Michelle Allen, who helps me in my online Helping Older Parents programs. So we have a video on how to pay for elder care, because we're asked about that quite a lot. And that's when we go through the different options for providing this type of care that I am listing here. So next, there's the step of expressing your values and preferences. So people, when I tell them to, you know, it'd be good to plan for your last years, what it might look like, people sometimes think they have to have it all mapped out. And you don't. It's actually extremely hard to plan for all the eventualities ahead of time. What you can do is identify key values and preferences, because then those serve as a compass for your decision makers to use when the time comes. So to do this, there are some great conversation guides available. Some of my favorites are available at, you know, one, prepareforyourcare.org, two, theconversationproject.org, and then the Prepare website even now has prepareforthircare.org to help somebody else plan as well. Next thing to do is to choose surrogate decision makers and do the legal paperwork. This means choosing someone who will make decisions on your behalf if at some point you are unable to do so. And like, quite a lot of people will go through at least a temporary stage of not being able to make their decisions before they die. So I really think this is a good thing to do. And generally there are two roles, but you can pick the same person if you want. You pick somebody to make your healthcare decisions for you, and then you pick somebody to make your general and financial decisions for you. And to finalize this, you'll need to complete legal paperwork, such as a power of attorney document to do it. So some of the pitfalls that I see that I want to encourage you to avoid: don't forget to complete your legal paperwork. It's especially important to do it for the general affairs and financial affairs, because if for some reason you're not able to manage your finances and you get hit by a bus or something like that and your family needs to step in with that, there's actually no mechanism where family just get to step in because somebody's injured. They actually do have to go to court. Now, for health decisions, generally in an emergency, the doctors can turn to other people, your next of kin, to do it. So I think the legal paperwork is important. It also really helps when there are multiple children or people involved, can help resolve disagreements if there's been one person clearly designated as the go-to. I also encourage people to review and revise their planning regularly. I have lots of people who tell me, oh, we did paperwork 20 years ago with an attorney. Your life is different now. Your understanding of your health is different now. The people you feel close to might be different now. It's really like important to periodically review this and revise it. And generally, I recommend doing this after any big life change or major diagnosis, and at least every few years. And then I also encourage you to talk with your surrogate decision makers, right? Because again, the better they understand how you've been thinking about how you manage your health or your affairs, the easier it will be for them to step in if it becomes necessary and act in the ways that are a good fit with what you would have wanted for yourself. So think about how to help them be prepared to make decisions on your behalf and share with them your reflections on what you were thinking might happen and what would be your preferences if it does happen. You can also consider involving them more in your medical financial affairs. I mean, maybe it starts off just as like a yearly sit down with the person who's your healthcare decision maker, you know, to kind of recap the major developments in your health and what's going on. And you could do something similar for, you know, your financial situation. Now, really quickly, what if you are the adult child? Because I do get approached by adult children who want to get their parents to plan for, you know, their aging, or maybe you're trying to help your spouse. It's understandable that we want to help people with this, but you got to be really careful about insisting that your parents or any other older person optimize their health or plan for interdependence. It would be great for them to do these things, and it's not your job to get them to do all these things. It often makes older people pretty defensive to feel pressured to do this by family members. Now, I think it's totally reasonable to bring it up, to remind them, to encourage it. You just want to be careful about too much insisting on it. So instead, what I recommend doing is trying to learn more about their priorities and perspective. What are their hopes and desires when it comes to this next stage of their life or their last years of life? What are their fears? How are they thinking that they would like for you to accompany them on their aging journey and through those challenges? And above all, focus on connection, respect, and empathy. Now, if you are somebody who has an aging parent and you've been worried about your aging parents, if you've been concerned about signs of potential decline, I did write a book that is exactly about this. It's called When Your Aging Parent Needs Help, and it provides a sort of step-by-step framework for assessing the situation, figuring out how bad it is, and, you know, how to get assistance from the medical system and the social care system. And so that's what I had to share for today. So to just recap my approach to planning for successful aging is not about never experiencing disease, disability, changes, loss of independence. Instead, it's about finding ways to cope and adapt by marshaling internal and external resources so that you can continue to experience life satisfaction, meaning, connection, and valued activities, even if, or really when, you experience personal losses, declines in abilities, or chronic health issues. And how can you prepare for this? You know, one, cultivate a positive attitude about your own aging. Two, work on optimizing your health and well-being now, because this will give you better quality of life in the short term and is also the best way to prevent or delay age-related problems in the longer term. And three, plan for interdependence. Expect that you will eventually experience some form of reduced abilities. Try to keep a positive and accepting attitude about this. And then take steps now. You know, you don't have to get it all done tomorrow. You know, it's a process. But try to take steps at some point to prepare and lay a good foundation for those future adaptations so that when the time comes, you have a foundation and you're more ready to step into that stage of interdependence and to accept help and support from others. My very top tips, based on my years of seeing older adults and families go through this, you know, one, relationships with others are essential to better aging. So cultivate those relationships and connections now, because they are what's going to help support and sustain you later on when you reach that stage where you might need help and support from others. You can also, right now, if you're well, consider how you can contribute to the lives of others. I really think that what goes around comes around. Another tip is I really believe that your relationship with your aging self is essential. And I want to just encourage every older person to reflect on that and think about how to make it as supportive as possible. A positive attitude about your own aging will help you a lot. So acknowledge and process any fears or uncertainties you have, and then work towards cultivating more acceptance and gratitude. And remember, it's not a failure to decline or need assistance. It's normal. It's human. It's the human experience. So coping, adapting, and learning to accept help is what we should all be expecting to have to do. Many older adults do succeed in doing this. And my hope is just that we can support more older adults in doing this successfully. So with that, thank you so very much for watching. And if you found this video podcast helpful, if you're here on YouTube, please go ahead and subscribe, as it does help more people find the channel. And if you're someone, again, who is trying to figure out how to help an aging parent, I have a special interest in supporting people like you. So I've created a variety of helping older parents resources and trainings. And I also have a book, When Your Aging Parent Needs Help. So if you'd like to get more useful information on how to care for your aging parents, including the free trainings, please visit betterhealthwhileaging.net. helping-older-parents. And then last but not least, if you've been listening to the audio version of this episode on the podcast feed, please come and take a look at the video if you get a chance. You'll see my key points displayed on the screen. So thank you once again, and I look forward to seeing you all again on a future episode of the Better Health While Aging video podcast.